who you talk to, and all of you will simply disappear. Captain, the major broke in. Sir, this guy has no business here, and if he talks, I can't guarantee anything. The captain complained as if he were trying to cover his ass to a superior who didn't know as much as he did. So forget everything you saw, the major said directly to Danzer, and hightail it out of here before somebody else sees you and wants to make sure you stay silent. Yes, sir, Danzer just about shouted as he extricated himself from the grip of the MPs on either side of him and broke for his pickup truck on the other side of the base. He didn't even look back to see the team of soldiers carrying the body bags of the remaining creatures into the hospital where, before there were any other briefings, the creatures were prepared for autopsy like bag game waiting to be dressed. The rest of the story about that week has become the subject of history. First, 509th Base Commander Bull Blanchard authorized the release of the flying saucer story that was picked up by news services and carried around the country. Then General Roger Ramey at 8th Army Air Force Headquarters in Texas ordered Major Jesse Marcel to go back before the press and retract the flying saucer story. This time, Marcel was ordered to say that he'd made a mistake and realized the debris had actually come from a weather balloon. Swallowing a story he himself never believed, Jesse Marcel posed with some fake debris from an actual balloon and confessed to an error he never could have made, even on a bad day. It was a confession that would haunt him the rest of his life until, decades later, and shortly before he died, he would retract his public story and restate that he had actually retrieved an alien spacecraft that night in the Roswell Desert. Meanwhile, in the days and weeks after the crash and retrieval, Army intelligence and CIC personnel fanned out through Roswell and neighboring communities to suppress whatever information they could, with ill-advised threats of violence, actual physical intimidation, and, according to some of the rumors, at least one homicide, Army officers bludgeoned the community into silence. Mac Brazel, one of the civilians near whose property the crash took place, and one of the visitors at the site, was allegedly bribed and threatened. He suddenly became silent about what he had seen in the desert, even after he told friends and news people that he'd retrieved pieces from a downed spacecraft. Officers from the Jaffa County Sheriff's Department and other law enforcement agencies were forced to comply with the Army edict, and the incident outside of Roswell was a matter of national security and was not to be discussed. It never happened, the Army decreed, and civilian authorities willingly complied. Even the local Roswell radio station news correspondents, John McBoyle from KSWS, and Walt Whitmore Sr. from KGFL, who'd conducted interviews with witnesses to the debris field, were forced to submit to the official line that the Army imposed and never broadcast their reports. For some civilians who had claimed to have experienced intimidation from the Army officers who fluttered into Roswell after the crash, the trauma remained with them for the rest of their lives. One was Dan Dwyer's daughter, who was a young child in July 1947 and who endured the sight of a huge, helmeted Army officer, his expression obscured by sunglasses looming over her in her mother's kitchen and telling her that if she didn't forget what she had been told by her father, she and the rest of her family would simply disappear in the desert. Sally, who'd played with the metallic fabric her father had brought back to the firehouse that morning and had heard his description of the little people carried away on stretchers, quaked in terror as the officer finally got her to admit she had seen nothing, heard nothing, and handled nothing. It never happened, he hissed at her, and there's nothing you will ever say about it for the rest of your life, because we will be there, and we will know it. He repeated over and over again, slapping a police baton into his palm with a loud crack at every word. Even today, tears form at the corners of her eyes as she described the scene and remembers the expression of her mother, who'd been told to leave the kitchen while the officer spoke to Sally. It's tough for a kid to see her parents so terrorized into silence that they will deny the truth before their eyes. Roy Danzer's daughter, too, was frightened at the sight of her father when he came home from the base that morning on July 5, 1947. He wouldn't talk about what had gone on there, of course, even though the town was abuzz with rumors that a creature from outer space had invaded Roswell. Wasn't it true that all the children in town knew about it, and there had been stories about flying saucers in the newspapers for weeks? It was even on the radio. But Roy Danzer wouldn't say a word in front of his daughter. She'd heard her parents talking through the closed door of her bedroom at nights and caught snippets of conversations about little creatures and, "They'll kill us all!" But she buried these in a part of her memory she never visited until her father, shortly before his death, told her what really happened at the base that day in July when the convoy arrived out of the desert. Steve Arnold stayed in Roswell, finishing out his official reenlistment with the Army, and, without his direct knowledge, remaining a part of my own team right through the 1960s. Some say he works for the government still, carrying out a job that fell to him right out of the New Mexico skies, pumping out this information from the Army or the CIA or whomever, perpetrating a camouflage story that 50 years later has taken on a life of its own and goes forward like a tale out of a Dickens novel, simply on inertia. You can see Steve today walking around Roswell, visiting old friends from his Army days, giving interviews on television to the news crews that periodically pay visits to the folks at Roswell who want to talk about those days in the summer of 1947. As for the debris retrieved out of the desert that July, it had another destiny. Shipped to Fort Bliss, Texas, headquarters of the 8th Army Air Force, and summarily analyzed for what it was and what it might contain, all of it was transferred to the control of the military. As quickly as it arrived, some of the debris was flown to Ohio, where it was put under lock and key at Wright Airfield, later Wright-Patterson. The rest of it was loaded onto trucks and sent up to a rest stop at Fort Riley in Kansas. The 509th returned to its daily routine. Jesse Marcel went back to work as if he'd never held the wreckage from the strange craft in his own hands, and the contractors returned to their work on the pipes and doors and walls at the base, just as if nothing had ever arrived there from the desert. By the time the first week of July 1947 was over, the crash outside of Roswell might as well have never taken place. Like the night that engulfs you as you drive through the expanse of desert and chaparral toward Roswell, so the night of silence engulfed the story of Roswell itself for over 30 years. These are the stories I heard as people later told them to me. I wasn't there at Roswell that night. I didn't see these events for myself. I only heard them years later when the task fell to me to make something out of all this. But the debris from the crash of the object that was either caused by lightning or our targeting radar, some say, and fell out of the sky that night was on its way to a collision course with my life. Our paths would cross officially at the Pentagon in the 1960s, even though, for a very brief moment in 1947, when I was a young major at Fort Riley, fresh from the glory of victory in Europe, I would see something I would tuck away in my memory and hope against hope I would never see again for the rest of my life. Chapter 2. Convoy to Fort Riley. I can remember a time when I was so young and feeling so invincible that there was nothing in the world I was afraid of. I had faced down fear in North Africa. With General Patton's army, I stood toe-to-toe against the artillery in Rommel's panzer divisions and gave them better than they dished out to us. We were an army of young men from a country that hadn't started the war, but found itself right in the midst of it before we even got out of church that Sunday Pearl Harbor was attacked. The next thing we knew, Hitler declared war on us, and we were fighting in Europe. But by 1942, we drove the Germans right out of Africa and jumped across the sea to Sicily. Then, while Mussolini was still reeling from the punches, we invaded Italy and fought our way up the peninsula until we came to Rome. We were the first invading army to conquer Rome since the Middle Ages, and obviously the first invading army from the New World to ever occupy Rome. But there we were by early 1944, sitting in Rome after Mussolini fled and the German front collapsing all around us. And as a too young captain in army intelligence, I was ordered to oversee the formation of a civilian government under Allied military rule in the magical city of my ancestors that I'd only read about in history books. Pope Pius himself offered me an audience to discuss our plans for the city government. You can't even dream this stuff up. It has to happen to you in real life. And then you pinch yourself to make sure you don't wake up in your own bed outside of Pittsburgh on a winter morning. I stayed in Rome for 3 years from the months before the landing at Normandy in 1944, when the German front lines were still only a few miles south of Rome and our boys were slugging their way up the slopes of Monte Cassino, to early 1947, when I was shipped back home and my wife and I threw everything we had into the trunk of a used Chevy convertible and drove across the farmland state routes of peacetime America from Pennsylvania to Kansas. I'd been away 5 years, but now I was home driving top down across Missouri to an assignment that was considered a plum for any young officer on his way up the Army ladder. Military Intelligence School, only one step away from Strategic Intelligence, the Army's version of the Ivy League. I was moving up in the world. And what was I? Just a draftee out of Pennsylvania who was chosen for officer candidate school and now fresh from a wartime intelligence command in Allied occupied Europe and ready to begin my new career in Army intelligence. Having been in Africa and Europe for so many years, I was anxious to see America again. By this time, its people were not stooping under the weight of the Depression, nor in factories, nor in uniforms, sweating out a desperate war across two oceans. This was an America exultant in victory, and you could see it as you drove through the small towns of southern Ohio and Illinois, and then across the Mississippi. We didn't stop overnight to see St. Louis, or even to linger on the Kansas side of the river. I was so excited to be a career officer that we didn't stop driving until we pulled straight into Fort Riley and set up an apartment in nearby Junction City where we'd live while they got our house ready on the base. For most of the next few weeks, my wife and I got used to living in America again on a peacetime army base. We had lived in Rome after the war while I was still trying to help pacify the city and fend off the communist attempts to take over the government. It was as if we were still fighting a war because each day had brought renewed challenges from either the communists or the organized crime families who had tried to infiltrate their way back into the civilian government. My life was also in danger each day from the different cadres of terrorists in the city, each group with its own agenda. So in contrast to Italy, Fort Riley was like the beginning of a vacation. And I was back in school again. This time, however, I was taking courses in career training. I knew how to be an intelligence officer and in fact had been trained by British MI-19, the premier wartime intelligence network in the world. My training had been so thorough that even though we were up against crack Soviet NKVD units operating within Rome, we were able to outthink them and actually destroy them. Prior to the war, the United States didn't really have a peacetime intelligence service, which is why they quickly formed the OSS when war broke out. But the Army intelligence units and the OSS didn't operate together for most of the war because the communication lines were faulty, and we never really trusted the OSS agenda. now with the war over and Army intelligence having come into its own, I was part of a whole new cadre of career intelligence officers who would keep watch on Soviet activities. The Soviets had become our new old enemies. In intelligence school, during those first few months, we reviewed not only rudiments of good intelligence gathering, interrogation of enemy prisoners, analysis of raw intelligence data, and the like, but we learned the basics of administration and how to run a wartime intelligence unit called the Aggressor Force. None of us realized during those early days how quickly our newly acquired skills would be tested, nor where our enemies would choose to fight. But those were confident days as the weather turned warmer on the plains and the days grew long with the coming of summer. Before the war broke out and I was in high school back in California, Pennsylvania, my hometown, I was something of a bowler. It was a sport I wanted to get back to when the war ended. So when I got to Fort Riley, one of the first places I looked up was the bowling alley on the base, which had been built in one of the former stables. Fort Riley was a former cavalry base, the home of Custer's 7th Cavalry, and still had a polo field after the war. I started practicing my bowling again, and was soon rolling enough strikes that the enlisted men who bowl there began talking to me about my game. Before too many months had passed, Master Sergeant Bill Brown, the men called him Brownie, stopped me when I was changing out of my bowling shoes and said he wanted to talk. "Major, sir," he began, more than a little embarrassed to address an officer out of uniform and not on any official Army business. He couldn't possibly have realized that I was a draftee just like him and had spent the first few months of the service taking orders from corporals in boot camp. "Sergeant?" I asked. "The men at the post want to start up a bowling league, sir, have teams to bowl against, and maybe come up with a team to represent the base," he began. "So we've been watching you bowl on Saturdays." "So what am I doing wrong?" I asked. I figured at first maybe the sergeant was going to give me a tip or two and wanted to establish some authority. "Okay, I'll take a tip from anybody," but that's not what he asked. "No, sir, nothing at all," he stammered. "I'm saying something different. We, the guys, were wondering if you've bowled before. Do you think maybe you'd like to become part of the team?" He'd gotten more confidence the more he framed his request. "You want me for your team?" I asked. I was pretty surprised because officers weren't supposed to fraternize with enlisted men at the time. Things are very different now, but then, 50 years ago, it was a different world, even for much of the officer corps that started out as draftees and went through officer training. "We know it's out of the ordinary, sir, but there are no rules against it." I gave him a very surprised look. "We checked." This was obviously not a spur-of-the-moment question. "You think I can hold up my end of things?" I asked. "It's been a long time since I've bowled against anybody." "Sir, we've been watching. We think you'll really help us out. Besides," he continued, "we do need an officer on the team." Whether out of modesty or because he didn't want to put me off, he had completely understated the nature of the bowling team. These guys had been champions in their own hometowns, and years later you could have found them on Bowling for Dollars. There was no reason in the world I should have been on that team except that they wanted an officer because it would give them prestige. I told him I'd get back to him on it because I wanted to check on the rules, if there were any, for myself. In fact, officers and enlisted personnel were allowed to compete on the same athletic teams, and in very short order, I joined the team, along with Dave Bender, John Miller, Brownie, and Sal Federico. We became quite a remarkable team, winning most of our matches, more than a few trophies, and had lots of exciting moments when we made the impossible splits and bowled our way all the way to the state finals. We ultimately won the Army Bowling Championships, and the trophy sits on my desk to this very day. Magically, the barrier between officer and enlisted man seemed to drop, and that's the real point of this story. Through the months I'd spent on the team, I became friends with Bender, Miller, Federico, and Brown. We didn't socialize much except for the bowling, but we also didn't stand on ceremony with each other. I liked it that way. I found that a lot of the career intelligence officers also like to see some of the barriers drop because sometimes men will speak with more honesty to you if you don't throw what's on your shoulders into their faces every time you talk to them. So I became friends with these guys. And that's what got me into the veterinary building on Sunday night, July 6th, 1947. I remember how hot it had been that whole weekend of July 4th celebrations and fireworks. These were the days before everybody had to have air conditioning. So we just sweltered inside the offices at the base and swatted away the fat, lazy flies that buzzed around looking for a hot dog crumb or landing on chunks of pickle relish. By Sunday, the celebrations were over. Guys who had too much beer had been dragged off to their barracks by members of their company before the MPs got hold of them, and the base was settling down to the business of the week. Nobody seemed to take much notice of the 5 deuce-and-a-halves and side-by-side lowboy trailers that had pulled into the base that afternoon full of cargo from Fort Bliss in Texas on their way to the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field in Ohio. If you had looked at the cargo manifest the drivers were carrying, you'd have seen lists itemizing landing gear assembly struts for B-29s, wing tank pods for vintage P-51s, piston rings for radial aircraft engines, 10 crates of Motorola walkie-talkies, and you wouldn't think anything of the shipment except for the fact that it was going the wrong way. These spare parts usually shipped from Wright Field to bases like Fort Bliss rather than the other way around, but of course, I wouldn't know that until years later when the real cargo on those trucks fell straight into my desk as if they dropped out of the sky. It got quiet that evening right after dark, and I remember that it was very humid. Off in the distance you could see lightning, and I wondered if the storms were going to reach the base before morning. I was the post-duty officer on that night, similar to the chief duty officer of the watch on a naval vessel, and hoped more fervently that if a storm were on its way, it would wait until morning to break so I might be spared walking through the mud from sentry post to sentry post in the midst of a summer downpour. I looked over the sentry duty roster for that night and saw that Brownie was standing post over at one of the old veterinarian buildings near the center of the compound. The post-duty officer spends his night at the main base headquarters where he watches the phones and is the human firewall between an emergency and a disaster. Not much to do unless there's a war on or a company of roustabouts decides to tear up a local bar. And by late night, the base settles into a pattern. The sentries walk their post, the various administrative offices close down, and whoever is on night watch takes over the communication systems, which, in 1947, consisted primarily of telephone and telex cable. I had to walk a beat as well, checking the different buildings and the sentry post to make sure everyone was on duty. I also had to close down the social clubs. After I made my obligatory stops at the enlisted men's and officers' clubs, shutting down the bars and tossing, with all due respect to the senior officers, the drunks back to their quarters, I footed it over to the old veterinary building where Brown was standing watch. But when I got there where he was supposed to be, I didn't see him. Something was wrong. "Major Corso!" a voice hissed out of the darkness. It had an edge of terror and excitement to it. "What the hell are you doing in there, Brownie?" I began, cussing out the figure that peeked out from me but behind the door. "Have you gone off your rocker?" He was supposed to be outside the building, not hiding in a doorway. It was a breach of duty. "You don't understand, Major," he whispered again. "You have to see this." "Better be good," I said, as I walked over to where he was standing and waited for him outside the door. "Now you get out here where I can see you." Brown popped his head out from behind the door. "You know what's in here?" he asked. Whatever was going on, I didn't want to play any games. The post-duty sheet for that night read that the veterinary building was off-limits to everyone. Not even the sentries were allowed inside because whatever had been loaded in had been classified as no access. what was Brown doing on the inside? Brownie, you know you're not supposed to be in there, I said. Get out here and tell me what's going on. He stepped out from inside the door, and even through the shadow I could see that his face was a dead pale, just as if he'd seen a ghost. You won't believe this, he said. I don't believe it, and I just saw it. What the hell are you talking about? I asked. The guys who offloaded these deuce and a halves, he said. They told us they brought these boxes up from Fort Bliss from some accident out in New Mexico. Yeah, so what? I was getting impatient with this. Well, they told us it was all top secret, but they looked inside anyway. Everybody down there did when they were loading the trucks. MPs were walking around with sidearms, and even the officers were standing guard, Brown said. But the guys who loaded the truck said they looked inside the boxes and didn't believe what they saw. You got security clearance, Major. You can come in here. In fact, I was the post-duty officer and could go anywhere I wanted during my watch. So I walked inside the old veterinary building, the medical dispensary for the cavalry horses before the First World War, and saw where the cargo from the convoy had been stacked up. There was no one in the building except for Bill Brown and myself. What is all this stuff? I asked. That's just it, Major. Nobody knows. The drivers told us it came from a plane crash out in the desert somewhere around the 509th. But when they looked inside, it was nothing like they'd ever seen before. Nothing from this planet. It was the silliest thing I'd ever heard. Enlisted men's tall stories that floated from base to base, getting more inflated with every lap around the track. Maybe I wasn't the world's smartest guy, but I had enough engineering and intelligence schooling to pick my way around a piece of wreckage and come up with 2 plus 2. We walked over to the tarpaulin-shrouded boxes and I threw back the edge of the canvas. You're not supposed to be in here, I told Brownie. You better go. I'll watch outside for you, Major. I almost wanted to tell him that's what he was supposed to be doing all along instead of snooping into classified material, but I did what I used to do best and kept my mouth shut. I waited while he took up his position at the door to the building before I dug any further into the boxes. There were about 30-odd wooden crates nailed shut and stacked up together against the far wall of the building. The light switches were the push type, and I didn't know which switch tripped which circuit. So I used my flashlight and stumbled around until my eyes got used to the darkness and shadows. I didn't want to start pulling apart the nails, so I set the flashlight off to one side where it could throw light on the stack and then search for a box that I could open easily. Then I found an oblong box off to one side with a wide seam under the top that looked like it had already been opened. It looked like either the strangest weapons crate you'd ever see or the smallest shipping crate for a coffin. Maybe this was the box that Brownie had seen. I brought the flashlight over and set it up high on the wall so it would throw as broad a beam as possible. Then I set to work on the crate. The top was already loose. I was right. This one had just been opened. I jimmied the top back and forth, continuing to loosen the nails that had been pried up with a nail claw, until I felt them come out of the wood. Then I worked along the sides of the 5 or so foot box until the top was loose all the way around. Not knowing which end of the box was the front, I picked up the top and slid it off to the edge. Then I lowered the flashlight and looked inside, and my stomach rolled up into my throat, and I almost became sick right then and there. Whatever they'd created this way, it was a coffin, but not like any coffin I'd ever seen before. The contents, enclosed in a thick glass container, was submerged in a thick, light blue liquid, almost as heavy as gelling solution of diesel fuel. But the object was floating, actually suspended, and not sitting on the bottom with the fluid over the top, and it was soft and shiny as the underbelly of a fish. At first I thought it was a dead child they were shipping somewhere, but this was no child. It was a 4-foot, human-shaped figure with arms, bizarre-looking 4-fingered hands. I didn't see a thumb, thin legs, and feet, and an oversized incandescent light bulb-shaped head that looked like it was floating over the balloon gondola for a chin. I know I must have cringed at first, but then I had the urge to pull off the top of the liquid container and touch the pale gray skin. But I couldn't tell whether it was skin, because it also looked like a very thin one-piece head-to-toe fabric covering the creature's flesh. Its eyeballs must have rolled all the way back in its head, because I couldn't see any pupils, or iris, or anything that resembled a human eye. But the eye sockets themselves were oversized and almond-shaped and pointed down to its tiny nose, which didn't really protrude from the skull. It was more like the tiny nose of a baby that never grew as the child grew, and it was mostly nostril. The creature's skull was overgrown to the point where all of its facial features, such as they were arranged absolutely frontally, occupying only a small circle on the lower part of the head. The protruding ears of a human were non-existent. Its cheeks had no definition, and there were no eyebrows or any indications of facial hair. The creature had only a tiny flat slit for a mouth, and it was completely closed, resembling more of a crease or indentation between the nose and the bottom of the chinless skull than a fully functioning orifice. I would find out years later how it communicated, but at that moment in Kansas, I could only stand there in shock over the clearly non-human face suspended in front of me in a semi-liquid preservative. I could see no damage to the creature's body and no indication that it had been involved in any accident. There was no blood. Its limbs seemed intact, and I could find no lacerations on the skin or through the gray fabric. I looked through the crate encasing the container of liquid for any paperwork or shipping invoice or anything that would describe the nature or origin of this thing. What I found was an intriguing Army intelligence document describing the creature as an inhabitant of a craft that had crash-landed in Roswell, New Mexico earlier that week, and a routing manifest for the creature to a login officer at the Air Materiel Command at Wright Field, and from him to the Walter Reed Army Hospital's morgue pathology section where, I supposed, the creature would be autopsied and stored. It was not a document I was meant to see, for sure, so I tucked it back in the envelope against the inside wall of the crate. I allowed myself more time to look at the creature than I should have, I suppose, because that night I missed the time checks on the rest of my rounds and believed I'd have to come up with a pretty good explanation for the lateness of my other stops to verify the sentry assignments. But what I was looking at was worth any trouble I'd get into the next day. This thing was truly fascinating and at the same time utterly horrible. It challenged every conception I had, and I hoped against hope that I was looking at some form of atomic human mutation. I knew I couldn't ask anybody about it, and because I'd hoped I would never see its like again, I came up with explanation after explanation for its existence. Despite what I'd read on the enclosed document, it was shipped from Hiroshima. It was the result of a Nazi genetic experiment. It was a dead circus freak. It was anything but what I knew it said it was. What it had to be. An extraterrestrial. I slid the top of the crate back over the creature, knocked the nails loosely into their original holes with the butt end of my flashlight, and put the tarp back in position. Then I left the building and hoped I could close the door forever on what I'd seen. Just forget it, I told myself. You weren't supposed to see it, and maybe you can live your whole life without ever having to think about it. Maybe. Once outside the building, I rejoined Brownie at his post. "You know you never saw this," I said, "and you tell no one." "Saw what, Major?" Brownie said. And I walked back to the base general quarters, the image of the creature suspended in that liquid fading away with each and every step I took. By the time I slid back behind the desk, it was all a dream. No, not a dream, a nightmare. But it was over, and I hoped it would never come back. Chapter 3. The Roswell Artifacts. The nightmare of the creature I saw at Fort Riley never faded from my memory. Although I was able to bury it during my years as a guided missile commander in Europe, and I never saw its body again the rest of my life except for the autopsy photos and the medical examiner's sketches that would catch up to me along with the rest of what happened at Roswell when I returned to Washington from Germany for assignment at the Pentagon in 1961. I can remember my first day back when I was waiting outside my boss's door for entry into the inner sanctum. And boy, was I ever nervous. The last time I remembered being that nervous in Washington, I was standing in the little anteroom outside the Oval Office in the White House waiting for President Eisenhower to get off the phone. I'd had a big request to make, and I wanted to do it face-to-face, not go through any aides or assistants or wait for a special assistant, C.D. Jackson, to show up to make everything okay. I was almost a regular in the Oval Office those days back in the 1950s, dropping off National Security Council staff papers for the president, making reports, and sometimes waiting while he read them just in case he wanted me to relay a message. But this time was different. I needed to speak to him myself, alone. But Ike was taking a longer time than he usually took on this phone call, and I shifted around and sneaked a glance at the switchboard lights on Mrs. Lehrer's desk off to the side. Still on the phone, and you could see at the bottom of the switch panel where the calls were backing up. I was asking President Eisenhower for a special favor, to let me out of my fifth year in the White House National Security Staff so I could pick up the command of my own anti-aircraft guided missile battalion being formed up in Red Canyon, New Mexico. Ike had once promised me a command of my own when I returned from Korea and was posted to the White House. And in 1957, the opportunity came up, a juicy assignment at a high-security base with the coveted green tabs and all the trappings, train and command an anti-aircraft battalion to use the Army's most secret new surface-to-air missile, and then take it to Germany for some frontline target practice right where the Russians could see us. In case of World War III, the order of battle read, Soviet backfire bombers will drop an inferno of high explosives on our position first, and the East German tanks will roll straight into our barracks. We stand and fight, torching off every missile we have so as to take out as many attacking aircraft as we have missiles, and then get the hell out of there. I could almost taste the thrill in my mouth as I waited for Ike to get off the phone that day back in 1957. Those were my memories this afternoon. As I stood outside the back door of General Trudeau's office on the third floor of the outer ring of the Pentagon, it was 1961, 4 years after I left the White House and put on my uniform again to stand guard across the electronic no-man's land of radar sweeps and photo sensors just a few kilometers west of the Iron Curtain. Ike had retired to his farm in Pennsylvania, and my new boss was General Arthur Trudeau, one of the last fighting generals from the Korean War. Trudeau had become an instant hero in my book when I heard about how his men were pinned down on the cratered slopes of Porkchop Hill, dug into shallow foxholes with enemy mortars dropping around them like rain. You couldn't order anyone up that hell of an incline to walk those boys back down, just too many damn explosives. So, Trudeau pulled off his stars, clapped a sergeant's helmet over his head, and fought back up the hill himself, leading a company of volunteers, and then fought his way back down. That was how he did things, with his own hands. And now I'd be working directly for him in the Army R&D Division. I was a lieutenant colonel when I came to the Pentagon in 1961, and all I brought with me were my bowling trophy from Fort Riley and a nameplate from my desk cut out of the fin of a Nike missile from Germany. My men made it for me and said it would bring me luck. After I got to the Pentagon, it was still a couple of days before my assignment actually began, I found out right away I'd need a lot of it. In fact, as I opened the door and let myself in directly to the general's inner office, I found out how much luck I'd need that very day. So what's the big secret, General? I asked my new boss. It was strange talking to a general this way, but we'd become friends while I was on Eisenhower's staff. Why not the front door? Because they're already watching you, Phil, he said, knowing exactly what kind of cold chill that would send through me. And I'd just as soon have this conversation in private before you show up officially. He walked me over to a set of file cabinets. Things haven't changed that much around here since you went to Germany, he said. We still know who our friends are and who we can trust. I knew his code. The Cold War was at its height, and there were enemies all around us, in government, within the intelligence services, and within the White House itself. Those of us in military intelligence who knew the truth about how much danger the country was in were very circumspect about what we said, even to each other, and where we said it. Looking back on it now from the safe distance of 40 years, it's hard to believe that even as big 8-cylinder American cars rolled off the assembly lines and into suburban driveways and television antennas sprung up on roofs of brand new houses in thousands of subdivisions around the country, we were in the midst of a treacherous war of nerves. Deep inside our intelligence services and even within the president's own cabinet were cadres of career government officers working, some knowingly, some not, for the Soviet Union by carrying out policies devised inside the KGB. Some of the position papers that came out of these offices made no sense otherwise. We also knew the CIA had been penetrated by KGB moles, just as we knew that some of our own policymakers were advocating ideas that would only weaken the United States and lead us down the paths that serve the best interests of our enemies. A handful of us knew the awful truth about Korea. We lost it not because we were beaten on the battlefield, but because we were compromised from within. The Russian advisors fighting alongside the North Koreans were given our plans even before they reached those of us on MacArthur's staff. And when we threw our best technology into the field and into the air, the Soviets had already formulated plans to capture it and take it back to Russia. When the time came to talk peace at Panmunjom and negotiate a POW exchange, I knew where those Americans were, 10 miles north of the border, who wouldn't be coming home. And there were people right inside our own government who let them stay there, in prison camps, where some of them might be alive to this very day. So General Trudeau gave me his very grim smile and said, as he walked me toward the locked, dark, olive military file cabinet on the wall of his private office, "I need you to cover my back, Colonel. I need you to watch, because what I'm going to do, I can't cover it myself." Whatever Trudeau was planning, I knew he'd tell me in his own time, and he'd tell me only what he thought I needed to know when I needed it. For the immediate present, I was to be a special assistant in R&D, one of the most sensitive divisions in the whole Pentagon bureaucracy, because that was where the most classified plans of the scientists and weapons designers were translated into the reality of defense contracts. R&D was the interface between the gleam in someone's eye and a piece of hardware prototype rolling out of a factory to show its potential for the Army brass. Only it was my job to keep it a secret while it was being developed. "But there's something else I want you to do for me, Phil," General Trudeau continued as he put his hand on top of the cabinet. "I'm going to have this cabinet moved downstairs to your office." The general had me put in an office on the second floor of the outer ring directly under him. That way, as I would soon find out, whenever he needed me in a hurry, I could get upstairs and through the back door before anybody even knew where I was. "This has some special files, war material you've never seen before, that I want to put under your foreign technology responsibilities," he continued. My specific assignment was to the Research and Development Division's Foreign Technology Desk, what I thought would be a pretty dry post because it mainly required me to keep up with the kinds of weapons and research our allies were doing. Read the intelligence reports, review films of weapons tests, debrief scientists and the research people at universities on what their colleagues overseas were doing, and write up proposals for weapons the Army might need. It was important, and it's had its share of cloak and dagger, but after what I'd been through in Rome chasing down the Gestapo and SS officers the Nazis left behind, and the Soviet NKVD units masquerading themselves as Italian communist partisans, it seemed like a great opportunity to help General Trudeau keep some of the Army's ideas out of the hands of the other military services. But then I didn't know what was inside that file cabinet. The Army generally categorized the types of weapons research it was doing into two basic groups, domestic and foreign. There was the research that sprang out of work going on in the United States and research by people overseas. I knew I'd be keeping track of what the French were doing with advanced helicopter design and whether the British would be able to build a practical vertical takeoff and landing fighter, something we'd given up on after World War II. Then there was the German big gun, the V-3, granddaughter of Big Bertha that the Germans had threatened Paris with during the First World War. We'd found the barrel assemblies of the German artillery pieces near Calais after we invaded Normandy, and I knew the Nazis were working on something like that. Like their jet engine fighter and the new panzer tank could have changed the outcome of the war if they'd held us off any longer at the Battle of the Bulge. I was responsible for developing this technology, ideas we hadn't come up with ourselves, and work up recommendations for how we could incorporate this into our weapons planning. But I didn't know why the general kept on patting the top drawer of that file cabinet. "I'll get to these files right away if you like, General," I said, "and write up some preliminary reports on what I think about it." "It's going to take you a little longer than that, Phil," Trudeau said. Now he was almost laughing, something he didn't do very much in those days. In fact, the only time I remember him laughing that way was after he'd heard that his name had been put up to command the U.S. forces in Vietnam. He also heard that they wanted me to head up the intelligence section for the Army Special Forces Command in Vietnam. We both knew that the Army mission in Vietnam was headed for disaster because it was a think tank war. And the people in the think tank were more worried about restraining the Army than in wiping out the Viet Cong. So Trudeau had a plan. "We'll either win the war or get court-martialed," he said, "but they'll know we were there." And he laughed when he said that, the same way he was laughing as he told me to take my time with the contents of the file cabinet. "You'll want to think about this before you start writing any reports," he said. I couldn't help but pick up the nervousness in his voice, forcing itself through his laughter. That same sound over the phone that got me nervous when I heard it the first time. There was really something here he wasn't telling me. "Is there something else I should know about this, General?" I asked, trying not to show any hesitation in my voice. "Business as usual, nothing out of the ordinary, nothing anybody can throw my way that I can't handle." "Actually, Phil, the material in this cabinet is a little different from the run-of-the-mill foreign stuff we've seen up to now. And I don't know if you've ever seen the intelligence on what we've got here when you were over in the White House. But before you write up any summaries, maybe you should do a little research on the Roswell file." Now, I'd heard more about Roswell than I was ready to admit right on the spot my first day at the Pentagon. And there were more wild stories floating around about Roswell and what we were still doing there than anyone could have imagined. But I hadn't made the connection between the Roswell files and what was in the cabinet General Trudeau was talking about. Basically, I had hoped after Fort Riley it would all go away, and I could simply stick my head in the sand and worry about things I could get my brain around, like bureaucratic infighting inside Washington instead of little aliens inside sealed coffins. The general didn't wait for me to answer him. He left me standing there in his office and walked out to the reception room where I heard him giving orders into a speakerphone. He had barely clicked off the speaker and walked back to where I was standing when four enlisted men pulling a hand truck showed up, saluted, and stood there at attention while Trudeau kept looking at me. He didn't say anything. He turned to the enlisted men instead. Load up this cabinet on that dolly and follow the colonel to his office on the second floor. Don't stop for anybody. Don't talk to anybody. If anybody stops you, you tell them to see me. That's an order. Then he turned back to me. Why don't you take some time with this, Phil? He paused. But not too much time. Sergeant? He turned his attention back to the enlisted man with the shortest haircut. Please see the colonel back to his own office below. They loaded the file cabinet onto the dolly as if there were nothing inside, pulled it toward the back door, and stared at me until I followed them out. Not too much time, Colonel, General Trudeau called after me as we went out the door down the hall. I remember I spent quite a while just looking at that cabinet after it was loaded off the dolly and set up in my inner office. There was an almost ominous quality to it that belied its quiet, official army presence. So I must confess that, given the reverse hype of the general's introduction, part of me wanted to tear it open right away as if it were a present on Christmas morning. But the part of me that won just let it sit there, protected, until I thought about what General Trudeau had said about Roswell and the amount of paperwork that had circulated through the White House when I was on the national security staff there. No, I wasn't going to review the Roswell files. Not just yet. Not until I took a long, hard look at what was inside this file cabinet. But even that was going to wait until the rest of my office was set up. Whatever I was supposed to do, I wanted to do it right. I spent a little time pacing around my new office while I thought some more about what the general had said, why this file was waiting for me in a private office, and why he had wanted to talk to me specifically about it. It wasn't lost on me that I had not seen one scrap of paper from the general covering his delivery of that material to me, nor my receipt of it. It could have just as easily been that this file cabinet didn't even exist. As far as I knew, only his eyes, and soon my eyes, would review it. So whatever it was serious and, only if by omission, secret. I remembered a hot July night 14 years before at Fort Riley when I was the young intelligence officer after having just been shipped back from Rome. I remembered being hustled into a storage hangar by one of the sentries, a fellow member of the Fort Riley bowling team. What he pointed to under the thick olive tarp that night was also very, very secret, and I held my breath, hoping that what was inside this cabinet wasn't anything like what I saw that night in Kansas, July 6th, 1947. I opened the file cabinet, and almost immediately my heart sank. I knew from looking at the shoebox of tangled wires and the strange cloth, from the visor-like headpiece and the little wafers that looked like Ritz crackers only with broken edges and colored a dark gray, and from an assortment of other items that I couldn't even relate to the shapes and sizes of things I was familiar with, that my life was headed for a big change. Back in Kansas that night in July, I told myself that I was seeing an illusion, something that if I wished real hard, didn't have to exist for me. Then, after I went to the White House and saw all the National Security Council memos describing the incident and talking about the package and the goods, I knew that the strange figure I'd seen floating in liquid, in a casket, within a casket at Fort Riley, wasn't just a bad dream I could forget about. Nor could I forget about the radar anomalies at the Red Canyon missile range or the strange alerts over Ramstein Air Force Base in West Germany. I only hoped all of it would never catch up with me again, and I could go through the rest of my army career in some kind of peace. But it was not to be. There, mangled like somebody else's junk, were the trinkets I knew would involve me in something deeper than I had ever wanted. Whatever else I had to do in this life, here was a job that would change it all. You know how in the movies when Bud Abbott would open a closet, see the dead body hanging there, close the closet door, open it up again, and find the body gone? That's what I actually did with the file cabinet. Nobody was there to see me, or so I believed, so I opened it, closed it, opened it again. But this was no movie, and the stuff was still there. So here it was, some of the material they'd recovered from Roswell. And now, just like a bad penny, it turned up again. I heard footsteps outside my door and caught my breath. There were always sounds in the Pentagon at night because the building was never empty. Somewhere, in some office, in parts of the building most people don't even know about, some group is planning for a war we hope we will never fight. Therefore, more than any other building except for the White House, the Pentagon is the place where someone is always walking around after something. General Trudeau peeked his head around the door. "Look inside?" he asked. "What'd you do to me, General?" I said. "I thought we were friends." "That's why I gave this to you, Phil," he said. But he wasn't laughing, wasn't even smiling. "You know how valuable this property is? You know what any of the other agencies would do to get this into their hands?" "They'd probably kill me," I said. "They probably want to kill you anyway, but this makes them even more rabid. The Air Force wants it because they think it belongs to them. The Navy wants it because they want anything the Air Force wants. The CIA wants it so they can give it to the Russians." "What do you want me to do, General?" I asked. I couldn't figure out what he was thinking, unless he thought I should just bury the stuff and leave it at that. "I need a plan from you," he said. "That's simply what this property is, but what we can do with it. Something that keeps it out of play until we know what we have and what use we can make of it." This had all the makings of a plot, pure and simple. "Look, who's our biggest problem?" I asked. But it was a pro forma question because I already knew the answer. "The same people who lost Korea for us and who you had to fight over at the White House," he said. "You know exactly who I mean. We got to keep whatever's valuable here from falling into the wrong hands, because as sure as we're standing in this Pentagon, it'll find its way right to the Kremlin." There were people floating around Washington right at that very moment who, even out of the most well-meaning intentions they could muster, would have shipped this Roswell file over to Russia while patting President Kennedy on the back and congratulating him for contributing to world peace. Just as there were people who would have cut Trudeau's and my throat and left us right on the rug to bleed to death while they packed that file away. Either way, Trudeau didn't have to quote to me chapter and verse to explain that he was handing me one of the most important assignments I would ever receive from him. He was giving me the keys to a whole new kingdom, but neither he nor I knew what in the world we could do with this stuff short of keeping it out of the hands of the Russians. At the very least, that was a start. "We have to know what we have first," I said. "Then that's your job right away. What do we have? Anything usable here? Put together people you can trust from the specialists we have and go over the contacts at our defense contractor lists. And this is only part of the property we have. There's some more of it downstairs in the file basement that the other intelligence agencies don't know anything about. Came here from New Mexico instead of going out to Ohio. Don't ask me why. It's coming up to you right now in boxes. Just put everything together, take some time, and evaluate this for me." "Anybody know I have this?" I asked. "Everybody knows that if you're poking around something, it's got to be important. So don't act like the cat that ate the canary. They're watching you as much as they're watching me." Then he walked to the doorway, looked down both ends of the hall, and turned back to me. "But move this thing along, because we could be out of this office in under a year, and I don't want to have to worry about running out of time on this." And he was gone in a heartbeat, as if we'd never had the conversation. I didn't take the file apart that night, even after another nondescript wooden crate that looked like something you'd ship vegetables in was carted into my office by an equally nondescript Army corporal. I didn't go through the material the next night either. But over the following week, whenever I could be sure that no one was around who would pop in without a warning, I moved the material from the box into the file and allowed myself time to look at it. It was like falling through the looking glass into a different world, a puzzle of separate pieces that only vaguely captured what had been in the memos I'd read over at the White House. No wonder